Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm. As expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal, where we approach the 20th observance of 9/11. I want to review the bidding. I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005, and by 2006 it had taken off like a rocket. We had 400 to 600 members in four different categories, experts from all around the world. It was another exemplification of my promotion of collaborative research to sort out what really happened. Virtually everything we've been told about 9/11 by the government is false, provably false. The government knows it's false, but is nevertheless promulgating that information to mislead the public, which means, once again, the government has been lying to the American people about a matter of the greatest importance to the Republic. In particular, we were given the official narrative that 19 Islamic terrorists hijacked four commercial carriers and perpetrated these atrocities under the control of a guy off in a cave in Afghanistan. It was absurd. A half a dozen or more of these guys turned up alive and well the following day and made contact with the British media. Muhammad Atta, allegedly the leader, father, said he'd received a phone call from his son who protested he had nothing to do with it, was terrified he was going to be tracked down and murdered for good reason. David Ray Griffin makes this the very first point in his magisterial work, the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. Beyond that, Osama bin Laden, the purported mastermind, was our man in Afghanistan. He was instrumental in getting Stinger missiles into the hands of the Mujahideen, which they used to shoot down Soviet helicopters and planes to drive them out of that godforsaken region. He was actually an officer in the CIA, Colonel Tim Osman. An official from the agency visited him in a hospital in Dubai shortly before his death in Afghanistan on 15 December 2001. He was buried in an unmarked grave in accordance with Muslim tradition. There were local obituaries by the 26th of December. Both Fox and CNN had caught up with the news and were reporting that Osama bin Laden was dead. Nevertheless, Barack Obama found it politically expedient to resuscitate him and have him die again in a raid on a compound in Pakistan, completely staged, for the SEAL team that participated was loaded on an old Chinook Vietnam-era helicopter and shot down because dead men will tell no tales. This is a Barack Obama that the Democrats celebrate. They think is the greatest president in the history of the United States, but he was a phony, a fraud, and among the most corrupt of all presidents we've ever had. He thereby positioned himself for a triumphal reelection as the man who got the most wanted man in the world, but it was all a fraud. They even made a movie about it, Zero Dark 30. How bad is that? Nick Kohlerstrom, my dear colleague from the UK, published an article about, you can find on my blog, now jameshfetzer.org, Osama bin Laden, 1957 to 2001. As a founder of Scholars, I was maintaining a website at 911scholars.org now in its current incarnation, where because they've taken my blog in this completely improper action that was intended to deny the public access to the vast repository of information I have about Sandy Hook, right as the Alex Jones trial was about to demonize and savage me as batshit crazy, where the public might have wanted to learn what this batshit crazy guy had to say about 9/11. So now if you go to jamesfetzer.org, you're going to see documents that are not even current about the taking order and my reasons for objecting about how it was improper because a monetary judgment can only be satisfied by a monetary award. My blog and even the book are intellectual property. They would have to be consigned to a receiver who would put them up for bids in order to translate them into money not given directly to the plaintiff, Leonard Bosner, which is what the court did in this case. This is completely outrageous. I protested to the U.S. Supreme Court. I can do this because my petition before the court for the improper summary judgment procedures used against me to find me guilty of defamation allow the judge to exercise his subjective opinion to facts to resolve conflicts, because if they're disputed facts, it has to go to a jury. I was denied the right to a jury trial by the judge, denying all the facts that it was a FEMA drill promoted as mass murder to promote gun control, that we even have the FEMA manual, that the FBI in its 2012 Consolidated Crime Report for Newtown, zero murders or non-negligent manslaughters, that the official account of Sandy Hook by Danbury State's Attorney Stephen Sadinsky III fails to create a causal nexus connecting the alleged shooter, Adam Lanza, with the victims he's alleged to have used in the weapons. All that was simply set aside or really turned into non-facts by the judge by exercising his right to exclude unreasonable any evidence or facts he considered to be unreasonable, which is itself preposterous. Conflicts with other states, this case would have been turned out or gone to a jury trial where I have no doubt the evidence I presented, I would have prevailed against a defamation suit. It was absurd. That's before the Supreme Court, and consequently the taking order allowed me, when it was denied by the same judge who'd found me guilty of defamation by ruling that all my facts were unreasonable, I was able to appeal directly to the justice for the Seventh Circuit, which includes Wisconsin, Amy Coney Barrett. For reasons I do not profess to understand, she denied my appeal, granting a stay for lawful orders is frequently done by the court when a case is pending. This was granted a stay for an unlawful order, ought to have been a piece of cake. Under the rules of the court, however, I'm able to appeal a denial by one justice to another, which I have done. I'm now submitted to the court to Justice Neil Gorsuch, which will enable him the opportunity to rule on this case. And if he is negative as well, then he shares copies of my appeal, which are going to be posted and are actually identical with that you will already find on the Supreme Court docket for this appeal, which Justice Barrett has denied. Well, it's very obvious that this is an extremely important case, not just the stay order, which ought to be denied, but because it involves a Seventh Amendment, my petition to the Supreme Court for a writ of certiorari, which will be determined on the 28th of September. There's a conference, and I'll know by the 3rd of October whether or not it will be heard by the Supreme Court. However, returning to 9/11 before us, Nick has a brilliant piece about Osama you can find, where it's very clear he was a CIA asset. You may or may not recall the Taliban said they'd be glad to turn him over if the United States had any evidence, any proof, that he was involved in 9/11. We could not produce such proof, but we went ahead and, you know, invaded Afghanistan anyway. Simply absurd. Meanwhile, let me take you back to that day. Those who see the video version will appreciate, but this is footage. What happened is, if you were watching a replay of MASH, then you were interrupted by the following reports. This is from the May Muscle website.
No second flight. It was a bomb. Bombed another building, not second plane. That was a bomb. Who said the second plane?
That's what we're told. The second plane.
No,
we saw it on television.
No, everything.
All right. Thanks a lot. This is...
of how much of the plane actually impacted the building.
You know, it might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. The only site is the actual side of the building that's crashed in, and as I said, the only pieces left that you can see are small enough that you could pick up in your hand. There are no large tail sections, wing sections, a fuselage, nothing like that anywhere around, which would indicate that the entire plane crashed into the side of the Pentagon and then caused the side to collapse. Now, even though if you look at the pictures of the Pentagon, you see that the floors have all collapsed. That didn't happen immediately. It wasn't until almost about 45 minutes later that the structure was weakened enough that all of the floors collapsed.
Jeff, it's a United Airlines plane. It's believed to be at that site outside Pittsburgh, isn't it?
That's exactly right, John, with 45 people total on board. And one of the more profound things today, the imprint of terrorism seared not only on Wall Street, but also on Main Street. Here you have an area 80 miles to the southeast of Pittsburgh, and this plane, which went down at about 10 o'clock this morning. We have rescue vehicles that came in earlier in the day, and they have turned up nothing. No one believed to be alive from this crash. Some of the media just getting back to the scene, which is about a quarter of a mile up on a hill back behind me. And so some of the first pictures just starting to come in within the last hour. I want to get quickly to Chris Kanicki. He's a photographer with the Pittsburgh affiliate, a Fox affiliate. He was back there just a couple of minutes ago. And Chris, I've seen the pictures. It looks like there's nothing there except for a hole in the ground.
Basically, that's right. The only thing you could see from where we were was a big gouge in the earth and some broken trees. You could see some people walking around in the area, but where we could see, there wasn't much left.
Any large pieces of debris at all?
No, there was nothing that you could distinguish that a plane had crashed there.
Smoke, fire?
Nothing. It was absolutely quiet. It was actually very quiet. Nothing going on down there. No smoke, no fire. Just a couple of people walking around. They looked like part of the NTSB crew walking around looking at the pieces.
How big would you say that hole was?
From my estimates, I would guess it was probably about 20 to 15 feet. Long and probably about 10 feet long or 10 feet wide.
What could you see on the ground, if anything, other than dirt and ash? And
you couldn't see anything. You could just see dirt, ash, and people walking around, broken trees.
Says that City Hall in Oakland will remain open. It will be business as usual. He is urging people to remain calm, given what is going on. Remain calm. Oakland City Hall will remain open, but in San Francisco, City Hall has been closed. Also, just getting word here now that a second United Airlines jet, Flight 175, from Boston to Los Angeles, is now missing. And if you're just joining us, there have been four separate plane crashes. Three of those planes were en route to California. Two were heading to LAX. Third was heading to San Francisco International Airport.
That was specifically the one heading to SFO, United Flight Number 93 from Newark to SFO. It apparently crashed in Pennsylvania, fairly close to the border of Maryland and not too far from Camp David. Why is that significant? Because one of the groups possibly claiming responsibility for all these terrorist attacks is the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And it was this week in 1978 that the Camp David Accords were reached. Is there a connection? At this point, we don't know, but it is important to be aware of that situation. In Washington, D.C., many congressional leaders have been transferred to a secret location. Some senators have described this as a second Pearl Harbor. And President Bush was in Florida this morning, but he made a brief announcement when the first attacks were clear on the World Trade Center, and he was heading back to Washington, D.C. At this point, we don't know exactly where he is. They are trying, they're not really broadcasting that information, but we are told that the president is safe right now.
We're waiting for a press conference to start in San Francisco from the Office of Emergency Services to discuss what the situation, what the city's reaction to all of this is going to be. But again, right now...
So that's the kind of report we were getting over the media that day. Now, there were four flights, two out of Boston Logan, one out of Newark, another out of Dulles. It turns out that all the security for all four of the airports was provided by ICTS, which just happens to be an Israeli firm. If you looked at that round in Shanksville, it was ridiculous. You heard Chris Kanicki reporting it was about 10 by 20 feet. Well, bear in mind, this was a Boeing 757 with a 125-foot wingspan with a tail that stood 44 feet above the ground. Where's the plane? If you look at real crash sites such as Missouri, Amsterdam, Russia, this bears no comparison whatsoever. In fact, both of the reporters who were interviewed said that the eerie aspect of the crash site was there was no sign that any plane had crashed there. Remember how we're told you can't prove a negative, which is ridiculous. You can prove there's no elephant in your living room by going to your living room and looking for signs of the presence of elephant. Finding none, you're entitled to infer that's because there's no elephant in your living room. If you go to Shanksville and look for signs of the presence of a plane having crashed there and find no signs of the presence of a plane having crashed there, you're entitled to infer that's because no plane crashed there. There's a really absurd attempt by apologists for the government account to claim that after the passengers, remember the let's roll fantasy, overtook the plane that had actually crashed into an abandoned mine shaft. This is about as absurd as it gets, but we even have GIFs portraying such an eventuality. We know what to do with planes that are with miners who are trapped in abandoned mine shafts. We bring out the bright lights and the heavy equipment and dig 24/7 in the hope that perhaps by a miracle someone made them survive. But in this case, with regard to Flight 93, even though there were 45 souls aboard, no effort was made to retrieve the parts of the plane or the bodies. I mean, this is just absurd on its face, and we're expected to believe this. There's a photograph by a woman named Val McCletchy that seems to show a cloud of smoke over the crash site, but it turns out that it more resembles what you'd see from a demolition than from a plane crash. It's not the kind of smoke you'd find from a plane crash. Moreover, when you check out the geography, it's over a pond, not the location where the plane is alleged to have crashed. You look at more evidence where planes crash, the kind of smoke is completely different. Meanwhile, pilots for 9/11 Truth have done brilliant work across the board. They've established that Flight 93 was still airborne after its alleged crash. According to ATC radar, air traffic control transcripts reveal United 93 is airborne after its alleged crash. In fact, it was over Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, after it had officially crashed in Shanksville. Similarly, at the Pentagon, We have only five frames that are released from footage at the Pentagon, even though the Pentagon has to be the most heavily surveilled building in the world. The frames that's been observed have the wrong date and time. They're from the second, not the first. I mean, not on the proper date and at the wrong time. One is conveniently labeled plane. If you look very carefully, well, there is something just above the gate mechanism that resembles a plane with a white plume. Then we see the growing fireball in the other frames. There's even reason to believe that the fireballs were fake, believe it or not. I asked Jack White, a colleague from JFK Research, to scale the image of a Boeing 757 to that of the tail in that first frame. He did so, and a 757 would have been more than twice as large. So something is completely wrong here. If you look at the alleged point of impact on the ground floor, it's only about 10 feet high and maybe 17 feet wide. There's chain link fence. There are unbroken windows. There are two cars that are on fire. There are two enormous spools of cable, but there is no massive pile of debris from an 100-ton airliner. There are no bodies, no seats, no luggage, no wings, no tail. As Jamie McIntyre was reporting, that collapse of the building only took place about 45 minutes later. I'm convinced it's because it didn't appear to be serious enough damage so that Rumsfeld had this additional taken place. And if you look at where it's being, cleared out, there's no signs of any intense fire, which is the reason I say that I believe the fireballs are even fake. You can look up on the third or the fourth floor, and there's a wooden stand appears for an Oxford Unabridged Dictionary. It appears completely bereft of any damage. Now, according to the official account, the plane came in, hit a series of lampposts en route to the target, barely skimming the ground at over 400 miles an hour. Now, had that been the case, it would have plowed up the Pentagon lawn. There would have been enormous furrows, tremendous damage, but yet we have, in what a classic photograph, two lime green civilian fire trucks that just happened to be in the area at the time. I don't believe the Pentagon anticipated this would be the case, extinguishing the very modest fires. And you can see the Pentagon lawn is perfectly green and serene, unblemished, no damage whatsoever, none. In fact, there are quite a few. The BBC did reports. They even came here, interviewed me in my home for 8 hours for their conspiracy files on 9/11. And then they used 7.5 minutes of me. They found what they thought was the oddest argument I made, though I gave them hundreds of proofs, which was related to the Pentagon. But here's some of the footage where you can see the clear Pentagon lawn. Here's another. Even after the collapse, clear Pentagon lawn. There's no debris whatsoever. Then later, it begins to show up. And I explained to the BBC, and this was the part they used, I thought that a C-130 that was circling the building had dropped this debris onto the ground, onto the Pentagon lawn, because it would have been too obvious to have enlisted men and officers carrying debris out onto the grass. They thought that was extraordinary. I frankly know no better explanation for the debris showing up. But the fact is they did a propaganda piece on 9/11. It was the first 15 minutes where Dylan Avery, who produced Loose Change, a snot-nosed kid, he had that like 3.5 minutes. Then they had Alex Jones, the messianic professor, for 4. And then me, the kooky professor, for 7.5. Or they would interview the pilot for the plane who said it was absurd. Notice he didn't say it was false. He said it was absurd. Now, by far the most interesting piece of fuselage on the Pentagon lawn was actually from a Boeing 757, but it was not all crumpled as you'd expect from a violent impact with a building. Shows no signs of having been exposed to an intense fire, and entwined in this piece of debris is a piece of vine not indigenous to the Arlington, Virginia area. Fascinating. Well, James Hansen, who is a retired attorney from Columbus, Ohio, tracked it down. 757 has a wonderful safety record. There are very few crashes. He discovered this had come from the crash of American Airlines 965 near Cali, Colombia, back in 1995, where the pilots lost their way and passed through a jungle where this vine is indigenous into the side of a mountain. And yes, guess what? An Israeli firm recovered the debris. So they held it back. They kept it in abeyance until they had the right occasion to put it on the Pentagon lawn on 9/11/2001. Here's a photo of the pilot saying it was absurd. But again, I reiterate, I know no better explanation. Not only that, but the plane just barely skimming the ground is supposed to take it out a series of lampposts. Six, for the effect of a plane moving 400 miles an hour hitting a series of stationary lampposts would be the same, by Newton's third law, equal and opposite reaction as if the plane were stationary and had been hit by the lamppost traveling over 400 miles an hour. It would have ripped open the wings where the fuel is stored. It would have mixed with oxygen, burst into flame. You would add cartwheel of debris all over the Pentagon lawn. But as Vivoy explained, the lawn was perfectly clear and initially free of debris. Now, a group calling them Citizens Investigative Team noticed that the official trajectory came in south of a Citgo station, but that there were witnesses who reported having seen a plane approach the Pentagon north of the Citgo station. This is rather fascinating. It turns out that Norman Mineta would testify to the 9/11 commission. He was in an underground bunker with Dick Cheney during 9/11, where an aide came up to Cheney and said, "Sir, it's 50 miles out. Sir, it's 40 miles out. Sir, it's 30 miles out. Do the order still stand?" And Cheney whipped around and said, "Of course orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary?" Well, the order had to be to not shoot down the plane. And, of course, the aide was asking because these planes were being used as weapons, or so we were being told, to attack these various targets, and one was approaching the Pentagon. So if you shoot down the plane, then, of course, you lose the plane and the passengers, but you do not lose the personnel or the property at the target. The plane flew toward the building and then swerved over the building. At the same time, a massive explosion took place in front of the Pentagon, giving rise to the impression that the plane had actually crashed into the Pentagon. But that was not true. It turned out, I mean, just as Jamie McIntyre would report, there were no signs of any plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. Dennis Camino has done brilliant work establishing it was actually an unmanned aerial vehicle that was approaching the building that fired a missile into the building. We even had video of the missile hitting the building into the West Wing, which had recently been reinforced and was the only of all of the wings of the Pentagon that had been so reinforced, where it took out a group of budget experts. You may or may not recall the day before Donald Rumsfeld announced that the Pentagon budget was missing $2.3 trillion. Now, even in Washington, that's not chicken feed. And that he was going to direct that it be investigated. Well, it appears the following day he had the budget experts all assemble in the West Wing with all the documents and records so they could be conveniently taken out by the missile fired into the West Wing. When I looked at the list of casualties from the Pentagon, 125, and found about three dozen accountants, budget experts, and financial analysts, I recognized this was the motive there for hitting the West Wing, not only, of course, because the Pentagon is a command and control of the U.S. military, so it could be portrayed as an act of war. Otherwise not a terrorist act, but not an act of war, but that this would conveniently dispose of the records and documents relating to the missing $2.3 trillion. And guess who was the controller, the chief financial officer for the Pentagon at the time? Dov Zakheim, who's not only a rabbi, but has a company that manufactures remote control devices to take care regain control of aircraft, which I believe was the original plan in New York City, an issue to which I shall return. In any case, a friend of mine had a trucker buddy in front of the Pentagon at the time who watched the plane fly toward and then swerve over the building. I said to my friend, I ought to get him on the air so he can tell his story, but he was reluctant. And when I reiterated that he'd be safer, my friend reported he'd been found dead in an abandoned building. He knew too much. I've advised others the best thing they can possibly do is to get their story out into the public domain, because then the reasons for taking him out become far less pressing. We even have a hole in the C-ring, and there are parties there that said they smelled cordite, which is a familiar military explosive that says punch out. It, perfectly symmetrical. Now, the plane hit the Pentagon at an angle. The Pentagon, of course, has these five rings, E, D, C, B, A. And if it had actually hit the C-ring with a part of the landing gear, as ostensibly occurred, it would have been asymmetrical. Intent is perfectly smooth, round, because it was done with using cordite. I reiterate again, you heard Jamie McIntyre reporting right from the scene that there was no sign that any plane had hit anywhere near the Pentagon. There was this small kind of debris, but no parts of any large plane, and that was a residue of the unmanned aerial vehicle. Jamie McIntyre was pressured to recant, and he went on the air and did it in the following way. He said, only a fool would deny that a plane hit the Pentagon, meaning he'd been a fool to think that his bosses at CNN wanted him to report the truth from the Pentagon. He would subsequently retire, even though he was by far CNN's best reporter. April Gallup, a civilian employee, also reported how when she came into work and touched her computer, there was this massive explosion in the front of the building that she actually walked out through the hole in the building and saw no plane debris, but she did smell explosive residue. Fascinating. We also have Major General Albert Stubblebine, who was interviewed in Germany. Stubblebine's important because he was head of all U.S. military signals, including photographic intelligence. And he explained to the reporter how he knew that no plane had hit the Pentagon, to wit, because there was no imprint of the plane on the side of the building, which has a sandstone surface or facade. Now, I'm a keen fan of Stubblebine, so I invited him to be my guest when I reviewed the evidence I'm giving you here for all four of the crash sites at Shanksville, Pentagon, North and South Tower. And not only did General Stubblebine agree with me across the board, he offered additional reasons why I was right. Meanwhile, afterward, there was a threat. This was supposed to be related to Flight 93, that the Capitol was next. So you had the members of Congress rushing out in front of the Capitol, and when they looked across the Potomac, they saw this billowing black smoke. Well, I thought that was very peculiar, because as I reported, those civilian lime green fire trucks had extinguished the very modest fires that remained. And what I discovered was the billowing black smoke was coming from a series of enormous dumpsters in front of the Pentagon. In fact, I would subsequently have a 9/11, a member of scholars, drop by my home in Duluth, where he showed me 44 more frames from a different angle where you'd actually see space between the dumpsters and the building. So it was just one more Hollywood-style special effect. Now, in New York, we had a different situation. Well, it was Boeing 757s at the Pentagon and the Shanksville, both of which were fabricated events, where it turns out that Flight 77 that's supposed to have hit the Pentagon wasn't even in the air that day, a point to which I shall return. In New York City, you had a French film crew that just happened to be in a certain position in New York City to swing the camera up to catch the hit on the North Tower. Now, a Scottish student of 9/11 has established that more than 100 improbable circumstances had to be satisfied in order to capture this hit in terms of location, timing, and the like. Moreover, consider when you hear the plane, because speed of sound is so much slower than the speed of the aircraft. It's no longer where you'd look if you heard the sound. But nevertheless, he swung his camera up and captured the hit. In other words, that's preposterous unless he knew exactly what was going to take place, because the whole thing was staged. And while they call themselves the Naudé brothers, it turns out that's an anagram of Duane Street, ST, where the filming took place. Now, if you look at a simulation of what a Boeing 767 would look like against the North Tower, it's a very substantial aircraft. But as the web fairy, Rosalie Gable, observed during the time sequence, it looked a whole lot more like a flying pig. It bore no resemblance whatsoever to a Boeing 767. And there's a flash frame when the hit occurs. Now, initially at the hit, it's like a Z, an elongated Z. But after the smoke clears, it's actually an elongated V. As in the case of the South Tower, it was like a cookie cutter cutout here, and where they even extended the impact of the wings, which was a dumb thing to do because these were very formidable steel facades around the building where wings couldn't possibly have penetrated the steel. I mean, the plane's made out of aluminum. We're talking about the equivalent of throwing an aluminum beer can at a brick wall. No matter how hard you throw, it's not going to happen. The beer can's going to crumble external to the building, body, seats, luggage falling to the ground, but that didn't happen at either the North or the South Tower. And indeed, it appears that the cutout was made behind the smoke and explosion blast while it took place. There's a lot of twinkling, which I've suggested might be what George H.W. Bush meant when he talked about 1,000 points of light, but it's clear it was fabricated. The plane on the North Tower was intersecting with 7 different floors. Now, each of the floors consisted of a steel truss filled with 4 to 8 inches of concrete, which the variance, because the trusses had V-shaped grooves that were 4 inches deep. So in some places, it would be for another 8 inches of concrete. Because the building were 208 feet on the side, we're talking about each floor representing an acre of concrete on a steel truss. The resistance thereby posed would have been enormous. Now, Steve Dack believes it's an interesting hypothesis that actually missiles were fired to create the cutout. So I thought it was a gelatin group. These Israeli art students are inside the building, but box after box of fuse holders had planted the explosive to create the cutout beneath the smoke and mirrors. But Steve Dack has been very insistent about it. Here's a photograph where you can see the boxes of the... These guys were doing performance art outside of the building. Quite extraordinary. They had virtually a free run, so that any prep work that needed to be done could thereby have been perpetrated by them. On the day of 9/11, there was a whole lot going on, really fascinating. These dancer art students had a variety of tasks, among them planting jammers on buildings to block Port Authority dispatchers and first responder radios, to plant explosives on the New Jersey side of the George Washington Bridge, where the cables are anchored, to collapse a bridge, explode a truck in the Lincoln Tunnel, explode a truck in the Harlan Tunnel, park trucks with demolition devices in specific parking areas of the Twin Towers. In other words, there's going to be an effort here to isolate Manhattan as an island. Now, one of the groups of these of Israeli students was observed in Liberty State Park, where they were celebrating, doing high fives as they videoed the demolition of the Twin Towers. A neighbor observed them and thought this behavior was so suspicious, he reported it to the police, who apprehended them in a van from Urban Moving System, which turns out to be an Israeli asset, which had a mural of a plane hitting the Twin Towers on the side. They found box cutters, explosive residue, passports, money inside the van. They were apprehended and held in custody for 44 days. Until Michael Chertoff, who was a deputy Attorney General to John Ashcroft directed they be released. They returned to Israel. Three of them went on Israeli television and explained they had been there to document the destruction of the World Trade Center, which obviously implied foreknowledge. They've come to be known as the Dancing Israelis. Chertoff would become the second head of Homeland Security. I'm just telling you, he, of course, is another dual U.S.-Israeli citizen. Meanwhile, when you analyze the speeds for the World Trade Center attacks, it turns out that they were traveling far too fast to have been consistent with the structural integrity of Boeing 767s. Here's pilots for 9/11 Truth have analyzed data provided by the National Transportation Safety Board, in which they concluded 510 knots and 430 knots for United 175 South Tower and American 11 North Tower, respectively, a benchmark set by the October 1999 crash of Egypt Air 990, a 767 that exceeded its maximum operating limits caused in-flight structural failure, which data is available to compare. In other words, it was not physically possible for these planes to have approached these buildings at the speed we find in the videos, particularly for Flight 175. The pilots for 9/11 Truth created a documentary entitled 9/11 Intercepted, which I recommend to everyone, where they showed the plane coming apart in flight as it approached the tower. Meanwhile, we have some 52 videos in relation to the South Tower. And in fact, it's simply astonishing what you'll find there, because this flight, which is supposed to be 175, just effortlessly enters the South Tower without showing any collision effects. There's no crumbling, there's no body seats, luggage, wings breaking off tail. It just effortlessly disappears into the building. This caused it to be referred to as the ghost plane or the butter plane, as though it were impacting with a 110-story gigantic cube of butter. I mean, how absurd is that? In this case, it was actually intersecting with eight of those different floors, each of which represents an acre of concrete on a steel truss. It would have been impossible, physically impossible, for real Boeing 767s to have entered these buildings. Jack White, who did that analysis, that comparison of the size of a Boeing 757 to what we saw in that first flame, did another study for me of the jetliner melting through the steel wall. Now, we have studied the number of frames it took for the plane to pass its entire length into the building with the amount of frames it takes for the plane to pass its entire length through air, and they are the same. In other words, this Boeing 767 purportedly passes its same length, entire length, into a massive 500,000-ton steel and concrete building in the same number of frames it passes through its whole length in air, which is obviously a physical absurdity, unless a massive 500,000-ton steel and concrete building poses no more resistance to the trajectory of an aircraft in flight than air. Many of you may be well aware of the nose-out phenomenon. Because of the way this was done, there was a hand-eye coordination glitch, and they actually allowed the image of the plane to come out the opposite side. So you have the nose-out, which is about as absurd as it gets. The nose of a commercial airliner is its most fragile part. It's loaded with electronics and other very sensitive gear that would have been smashed to pieces. When the nose out occurred, the networks went to black. They faded to black. There'd been a glitch. There'd been a blunder. It was going to blow the whole thing, the whole fraud. So they faded to black. I mean, can you imagine? Here you have this historic footage being filmed, reported live. And when a plane hits the South Tower, they fade to black. Why? Because the nose out had occurred and they did not want the public to see it. Ace Baker, who did a brilliant piece called the 9/11 Psy Opera, depicted what ought to have happened if a Boeing 757 had hit the building. It would have crumpled external to the building, body seats, luggage falling to the ground, tail, wings. None of that happened. Instead, we had this massive fireball, but it was extinguished after about 15 seconds. It was no longer the massive fireball. So we have the problem of what actually caused the buildings to be destroyed. We have photographs, we have video beneath the facades of both the North and the South Tower. You see a certain amount of debris there, but what you do not see is any bodies, any luggage, any seats, any wings, any tail. I mean, it's just ridiculous. No plane could have actually hit either the North or the South Tower without depositing all that debris, and it's not there. Once again, if it's not there when it should be there, you're entitled to infer that's because no plane hit the Pentagon. Meanwhile, Jack White once again discovered that noteworthy things were happening at Church and Murray. So Fox was there. An FBI van was parked with its door open. An FBI agent standing guard over something not seen in other photos. Blue-clad FBI agents appear beside the van are struggling with something heavy. There appear to be six and a photographer in the video frame. Another image taken at the deserted corner shows a dolly used for moving something. What does a complete video show? Well, underneath a steel scaffolding and a canopy, you had the engine of a 767, which was obviously planted there. It's sitting on the sidewalk. The sidewalk is not damaged. Anything that massive at that velocity would have churned up the sidewalk. But they didn't want New York to have to pay to replenish the sidewalk, and they were just faking the whole thing anyway, so they just left it sitting on the sidewalk. It's confirmable because of the rotator components that are visible that this was not an engine that was in use at the time. Now, Steve Dack has emphasized, if a bird doesn't vaporize in the process of slicing a wing, because we know the kind of damage is done to aircraft from a bird weighing only a few ounces, then a plane shouldn't vaporize during the process of slicing steel and concrete. Meaning, some have claimed, well, the plane just vaporized. This is like in Shanksville, where the plane just disappeared. That's not even physically possible. So anyone who's shoveling ship of that order, you know right off the bat they're lying to your very face. So where is the evidence that a plane created those holes in the North or the South Tower? Steve Dock's done a great job about this. We're also talking about Newton's third law. The plane would be exerting a tremendous force on the wall, therefore the wall would be exerting an equal and opposite force on the plane. The plane should be busting up on the outside. It said it disappeared. Now, some have sought to justify, and this includes individuals representing architects and engineers, which I long since concluded was a limited hangout. When you had a Phantom, F-4 Phantom fighter jet loaded on a railroad trestle and run into a nuclear-resistant concrete bunker, it was loaded with water, rocket propelled, and when it ran into the barrier, it just burst apart into millions of tiny, tiny pieces. What it did not do, however, was to crash through the bunker. And the idea that this should explain away what happened is simply absurd. The plane was made of some kind of synthetic filled with water, rocket propelled into the concrete buster. Here you had these aluminum aircraft that could not possibly have entered the buildings. It was physically impossible. Meanwhile, there's been a lot of study about how it was done. We have Rosalie Gable, the web fairy, suggesting it was done using CGI, computer-generated images. You got Ace Baker suggesting it was done by video compositing, whereby you add the image of a video between the time the original footage is shot and is set out to broadcast, which is about 17 seconds, both of which would have been possible. But the fact is, it turns out that there were witnesses, as many as 500, who reported seeing what they took to be a plane in real time. Now, if it had been either CGI or video compositing, then the image of a plane would only have been visible in the broadcast footage. It would not have existed in real time. So since we have hundreds of witnesses reporting in real time seeing what they took to be a plane, while they varied enormously in their description, some said it was a large plane, some a small, some commercial, some a military, they were reporting seeing a plane in real time. That is sufficient to exclude CGI or video compositing as explanation. What remains? Well, it might initially sound like a stretch, but it appears to have been a hologram. A fellow from the UK, Richard D. Hall, did a study. Now, we have some 52 videos of Flight 175 approaching the building. He found that 27 of them were sufficiently precise that he could create a plot of where the plane was as it approached the building and the exact time as it approached the building. So he created a plot. He discovered NIST had a similar plot that it claimed was based on radar data, but when he investigated their radar data, it looked fishy. He discovered independently there was radar data, and it showed a plane approaching the building, but 1,200 feet to the right of the plots he'd created. That led him to conjecture that what we had going on was a projection of the image of the Boeing 767 from another plane, almost certainly a smaller aircraft that could actually travel faster than a Boeing 767, that it flew that fast to preserve the integrity of the holographic projection, which is why the plane flew past the building, but the image exhibited the nose-out phenomenon. It was unintentional, but it was continuing to project. They didn't shut off the holographic projector fast enough. So what you have is an explanation that I take to be the correct explanation for what happened. Now, I'm given to understand that Richard D. Hall has now repudiated his theory. Well, let me affirm it. If Richard D. Hall has given up this theory, I, James H. Fetzer, have adopted it. So let's say it's a Fetzer theory, if it's not the whole theory, but I grant that he introduced it and he got it right. This is one of those cases where a person's later thoughts are inferior to their earlier thoughts, not the only occasion it's happened, but a rather striking example. And when you have that being the case, then you can explain the impossible speed. You can explain the impossible entry. You can explain why we had the nose-out phenomenon. There are those who insist that holograms require a solid surface and therefore have suggested that actually the hologram was projected onto a missile that was fired toward the building. Well, we all know that the military has technical developments that are not shared with the public until a decade or more later. And among the recent revelations of the last couple of years are that you have the capacity to use air molecules as a transient screen for the projection of a hologram. I was sent, by the way, a page from an Australian Air Force manual showing an airborne holographic projector. I'll read brief description. A holographic projector displays a three-dimensional visual image in a desired location removed from the display generator. A projector can be used for psychological operations and strategic perception management. It's also useful for optical deception and cloaking, providing a momentary distraction when engaging an unsophisticated adversary, and it shows a plane projecting such an image just as we had on 9/11. And get this, pilots for 9/11 Truth Track, Flight 175. It was in the vicinity of Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, after it had purportedly hit the South Tower. I mean, this is completely outrageous. And let me add that I obtained FAA registration records which showed that the physical planes used for those two flights, and remember the same physical aircraft, can be used for multiple flights, one day from Tampa to Chicago, the next day New York to San Francisco. The physical planes used for these two flights were not even deregistered or taken out of service formally until 28 September 2005. So since Edward Henry captured the Bureau's transportation statistics logs for 9/11, which showed that Flight 11 North Tower was not scheduled, Flight 77 Pentagon was not scheduled, they weren't even in the air, we're confronted with a conundrum. How can planes that were not even in the air have crashed on 9/11? And how can planes that crashed on 9/11 have still been in the air 4 years later? I reiterate, I reviewed all of this with Major General Albert Stubblebine, formerly in charge of U.S. military signals, including photographic intelligence. And Major General Stubblebine not only agreed with me about the evidence I'm reviewing here, but added, gave additional reasons why I was right. Remember, I pioneer collaborative research. I bring together experts from multiple different fields to guarantee that the chance of making a mistake is minimal. Aeronautical engineers, let me add, explain that the trajectory of a Boeing 757 at the Pentagon wasn't even aerodynamically possible because of a phenomenon known as downdraft, which meant that that plane at that speed could not have got closer than 60 or even 80 feet to the Pentagon, which is higher than the Pentagon at 71 feet is tall. So it wasn't even aerodynamically possible the Pentagon crash took place, as the government claims. We have been lied to head and shoulders, top to bottom, A to Z, about 9/11. It's outrageous. And when we return from our a break in a few moments, I will continue to lay out the evidence, including about how it was done, how the World Trade Center was destroyed. You may remember in that footage from that day, you had a pedestrian on the ground saying it was a bomb, saying it was a bomb. And you had the newsman saying, no, no, it was a plane. We saw it on television. Well, we can't believe everything we see on television. And remarkably enough, Donald Trump was the first personality to contest the official version of the attack on 9/11 on television that very day. After noting the engineers that built the Twin Towers were now working for him, he declared that it was impossible Boeing's going to burst through the steel structures, adding it had to involve something else, such as bombs. He got it right.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting "This is a drill, this is a drill" on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out "And Nobody Died in Boston Either." Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
If you think for 1 second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
A
yet, I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Amazon banned my book so you wouldn't learn what really happened at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill presented as mass murder to promote gun control. Then they sued to shut me up, and the Wisconsin courts played along. I have the proof and the law on my side. What I don't have is the money. They want to do to us what they've already done to Canada. Take guns, impose tyranny. It's on the way with Remington's help. First insurance, then registration, then confiscation. I'm asking SCOTUS to stop it. GiveSendGo.com, funding Fetzer. Check it out. This is for all the marbles.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Let me repeat, because this is so stunning, that Donald Trump was the first personality in the world to contest the official version of 9/11 on television that very day, having noted the engineers who built the Twin Towers were now working for him. He declared on New York's Channel 9 that was impossible that Boeings could have burst through the steel structures of the towers. He continued by stating it was also impossible that Boeings could have caused the towers to collapse. He concluded by affirming there'd be other factors of which we were as yet unaware, and he even used the word bombs. Bombs. Donald Trump. Now, many, we get a lot of complaints about Trump, but you got to realize the guy was surrounded by traitors. Just to offer a stunning illustration, Bill Barr, his attorney general, has come out to support the FBI in the raid of Mar-a-Lago and to claim that there's no justification for a special master. That is devious. That is evil. That is treasonous. Trump was being bamboozled. He was being sabotaged on every side. He was surrounded by advisors who were countermanding. They'd smile and agree with him in the Oval Office, walk out and shake their head and say, "We ain't doing that, all right?" I think the guy now knows enough to clean the, really truly drain the swamp. When you look at his Schedule F, you'll see the brilliance of what he has in mind. Do not lose faith in Trump. I don't know why he's hesitating, repudiating the vax. But I'm telling you, this guy has made a connection with the American people unlike any I've seen in my lifetime, in my opinion, even more profoundly than JFK and Jackie. That's amazing. JFK and Jackie were adored. They were loved by the American people. Donald Trump has just entrenched himself with us. He represents, really wants to make America better. And I know there are listeners here who are going to protest what I'm saying. I just want to understand what he was up against. Meanwhile, the Twin Towers were masterpieces of engineering design. They involved this tube-within-a-tube design, 47 massive core columns surrounded by 230 external steel columns, which were connected by the steel trusses filled with concrete, as I've explained. Won many awards. These were among the most robust and safe buildings in the world. Meanwhile, there was massive resistance by lower floors. The steel was 6 inches thick at the sub-basement, then 5, 4, 3, all the way up to the top, where the top 14th floor, where the steel was only 1/4 inch thick. What that meant was there was far less mass at the top part of the buildings than there was at the lower, and the resistance was simply overwhelming. There were, of course, altogether 7 buildings in the World Trade Center. We're only really primarily talking about 1 and 2, the North and the South Tower, and then later Building 7, which came down at 5:20 in the afternoon, 7 hours after the destruction of the North. That was a stunning development, and it was clear that was a classic controlled demolition. Meanwhile, there was a mass of asbestos in the buildings. The Twin Towers had large amounts of asbestos fireproofing that would have necessitated costly removal had they remained standing. The exact amount and distribution remains unclear, like other details, but the evidence suggests it may have rivaled the value of the buildings themselves. An estimate has it, there would be two ways of dealing with it. You could bring about a classic controlled demolition of the buildings, but that would have released all the asbestos into the air, so that was ruled out. Or you could build steel scaffolding around the building and remove it piece by piece, which would have run an estimated $1 billion per building. A report by Arnold and Porter Law Firm provides some details on asbestos application and removal. The WTC towers were built from 1968 to 1972. A slurry mixture of asbestos and cement was sprayed on as fireproofing. But this practice is banned by the New York City Council in 1971. Remember, it was actually opened in 1970. This resulted in spraying, but not before hundreds of tons of the material had been applied. Some, but not all of it, was later removed in an abatement program. After the effect, of course, it was as though all and only buildings with a WTC designation had been destroyed. It's absolutely stunning the precision with which the World Trade Center, and virtually only the World Trade Center, was destroyed. It turns out that there was an explosion in the sub-basement of the North Tower prior to the alleged collapse, which was no collapse at all, as I'm going to explain it. Now, Willie Rodriguez, who was a senior custodian, talked about this explosion in the sub-basement and how he had a co-worker who in the aftermath appeared with his skin barely hanging from his body. It was unbelievable. The claim was made that jet fuel falling through the elevator shafts caused this explosion in the sub-basement, but there was a hand-eye coordination problem here where, in fact, there was a glitch. The explosion was powerful, did a lot of destruction to the lobby and elsewhere, but we have seismic reports of the earlier explosions versus the seismic reports that occurred when the buildings would be destroyed, being called collapses, but actually it was something quite different. Two former members of scholars did a study about these seismic reports, which were very exact, and they found that while the commission claimed that the planes had hit, for Flight 11, it hit the North Tower at 8:46:40. Actually, the seismic report showed the explosion occurred at 8:46:26. In other words, there was a 14-second difference. The explosions occurred before the planes hit. Similarly, with Flight 175, The commission concluded that it had occurred at 9:03:11, but the seismic report showed it occurred at 9:02:54, 17 seconds. So we have refutations. They cause this, seismic proof that 9/11 was an inside job. There's no doubt about it. They got it right. Now, they had to destroy the World Trade Center in a very sophisticated fashion for the following reason. The two buildings were built inside of what was known colloquially as the bathtub. It was like a dike to keep Hudson River water from flooding the sub-basements. So based upon the bedrock, they created the bathtub perimeter, and the two buildings, the north and the south tower, were constructed within the bathtub. Afterwards, you can see exactly what remained because the bathtub was essentially completely intact. Had the bathtub been shattered, which would have happened at any significant portion of either the north or the south tower collapsed into the bathtub, you would have had Hudson River water flooding beneath lower Manhattan. This is the most valuable real estate in the world. So they had to ensure that didn't happen. There was some flooding of the tunnel connecting to New Jersey and of the subway that occurred nevertheless. Now, if you look at the destruction of the North Tower, it's very clear the building is blowing apart in every direction from the top down. And, of course, we know the North Tower very clearly distinctly from the south because of the giant antenna blowing apart from the top down, not collapsing. All the floors are remaining stationary and in place, but the building's collapsing from the top, is blowing apart from the top down. Now, according to the official account, there was a collapse that occurred like a pile driver. You had the top floors collapsing, and then they brought about lower floors and then lower floors. But as I have already mentioned, Chuck Boldman, a retired high school physics and math instructor, calculated. And for every unit of downward force, there were 199 units of upward or resistance. It was physically impossible for the Twin Towers to collapse. Here's one of his calculations right here. In this instance, the force of the weight of the top 16 floors was one vector force unit directed downward, also one gravity force unit directed downward. Then he shows the vector force units, the normal opposing vectors, as the interatomic and intermolecular electromagnetic bonding support forces directed upward. And in this calculation, he had the ratio of one downward force opposed to by 188. Simple linear vector force physics and math. In John Skilling vector force anti-crush down equation, where Skilling was a chi engineer, who explained how the buildings had been designed with a 20-time safety factor. In other words, they were actually designed to support 20 times their expected live load, which is a dead load, meaning empty, plus all the people, all the buildings, computers, furniture, and so forth, the live load, established the most conclusive and convincing proof of the impossibility of the collapse of the Twin Towers on 9/11. And yet we see they're converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. Here's a spectacular photograph. Judy Wood calls it the bubbler, where you can see Building 7 in the foreground as yet unscathed, while the North Tower simply disappears into a vast quantity, millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. Here we actually have some video, which Judy has emphasized, of this final core columns of the North Tower that are undergoing molecular disintegration and themselves turning into dust. Now, Judy claims this is evidence of the use of a directed energy weapon. Well, it is most certainly evidence of the use of unconventional weapons, but there's an alternative hypothesis as to how it was done that goes beyond both the alleged use of nanothermite, which architects and engineers has promoted endlessly, and the use of directed energy weapons, which Judy has promoted. It's fascinating. But here's a photograph showing the millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. The whole business appears to have been done by mini-nukes in some basement, so that the mini-nuke explosion went upward and destroyed the inner tower, and then the effects were what we saw visibly, blowing apart the outer tower. In the case of the South Tower, we had the unusual phenomenon that the top block started to tilt to the side before it was blown apart. Fascinating. So you had the inside of the tower vaporizing, and then what we witnessed externally was the destruction of the outer tube. The explosions that we witnessed were due to diverted overpressure waves guided by the path of least resistance. A focused gas flow destroyed the location of expansion, a paper snake effect momentum, hooting out squibs on the facade, while the lower portion of the building remained intact until the destruction was complete. Here we have the toasted cars, which Judy has emphasized endlessly. How is this possible? You have the destruction of the vehicles. Raging cars only inches away from undamaged paper. Here's a badly damaged fire truck. Where did the engine go? The bottom of the tire is turned to goo below a distinct horizontal line in the tire. A New York hazmat truck in front of the Building 6, the remaining upper part has been peeled and evaporated in areas. Now, that makes it sound as though it's very plausible that a directed energy weapon might have been used. But listen to this. Debris was ejected from the North Tower at a 45-degree angle. Massive debris upward and outward into the Winter Garden, which, as one of my colleagues has suggested, is where dews and nanothermite go to die. Get this. Jet fuel fires, even if they burned hot enough and long enough, would cause the buildings to sag and gradually collapse. Jet fuel could not have ejected 300 tons up at a 45-degree angle and 600 feet outward into the Winter Garden. To explode steel, an explosive needs to have a detonation velocity of 6,100 meters per second. To explode cement, a detonation velocity of 3,200 meters per second is required. Kerosene, which is a principal component of jet fuel, has a detonation velocity of only 1,600 meters per second. But get this, nanothermite, which has been so touted by architects and engineers, only has a detonation velocity of 895 meters per second. It can't possibly have had the effect. In fact, one of its proponents, Niels Harrit, who's an associate professor of chemistry emeritus from the University of Copenhagen, estimated, when asked how much nanothermite would have been required, 29,000 metric tons per building. That would be like filling the entire North Tower with circus peanuts. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's such a feeble explosive. It only has 1/13 the explosive power of TNT. So you might as well do it with TNT. But in fact, mini nukes would have had the observed effects. Mind you, the U.S. Geological Survey did dust sample studies from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan. They found a host of elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event, including barium and strontium. Neither of these elements should ever appear in building degrees in these quantities. The levels never fall below 400 parts per million for barium. Never drop below 700 parts per million for strontium. Reach over 3,000 parts per million for both in the dust samples at Broadway and John Streets. Thorium and uranium. These elements only exist in radioactive form. Thorium is a radioactive element formed by uranium by decay. It's very rare. Should not be present in building rubble ever. So once again, we have verifiable evidence that a nuclear fission event has taken place. Lithium, With the presence of lithium, we have compelling evidence that this fission pathway of uranium to thorium and helium, the subsequent decay of the helium into lithium, has taken place. Lanthanum, the next element in the disintegration pathway of the element barium. Tritium, the next decay element after strontium, which further confirms the presence of barium. Chromium, the presence of chromium is one more telltale signature of a nuclear detonation. Tritium, a very rare element that should not be found at concentrations 55 times normal in the basement of the WTC-6, no less than 11 days after 9/11, another telltale sign of the use of nuclear explosives. And by the way, it's a classic signature of the use of nuclear devices that they convert materials into very fine dust, which is precisely what happened at 9/11. A curse of ground zero. Number of cancer cases among 9/11 respondents and survivors triples to more than 5,400 in less than 3 years. This is dated. This is from way back in 2016. The number now is up to around 50,000. The number of 9/11 responders and others who've been diagnosed with cancer has tripled in less than 3 years. It turns out they have all kinds of odd multiple myeloma, leukemia, esophageal, pancreatic cancer, very similar pattern to what occurred at Chernobyl during the nuclear meltdown there. But Chernobyl, as you know, is in Ukraine, and where there's a fear we might have another nuclear reactor there now, which the Ukrainians are trying to bring about. Meanwhile, guess what? Reports for the reported WTC renovation that was taking place have disappeared. They were destroyed on 9/11. Turner Construction, who supervised the 2000 demolition of the King Seattle King Dome, participated in the post 9/11 ground zero cleanup, performed extensive renovations within the World Trade Center towers just prior to 9/11. It was in fact performing unspecified renovation work throughout the complex until the very morning of 9/11. The Port Authority of New York, New Jersey, which transferred the World Trade Center into the hands of Larry Silverstein Properties, now claims records destroying that work and other project were destroyed on 9/11. A December 2000 WTC property assessment required renovation work be completed within 1 year upon steel columns within elevator shafts of both WTC towers that was immediately pending or already underway. 12 employees at Turner Construction were located in an office in the third sub-basement at Tower 1 and had been performing renovation work in various parts of the center and various other spaces were like the gelatin group they had access. Now here's a building that actually collapsed. This is a fabricated concrete, not a steel structure reinforced, which are not vulnerable to collapse. But look at the massive pile of debris, whereas in the case of the Twin Towers, there was nothing left. Not only did we have exploding in all directions from the top down, but not only did we have all the floors remaining stationary, not only did we have the building being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, but when it was over, there was nothing left. Those buildings were destroyed to or even below ground zero. As Father Frank Morales from St. Mark's Episcopal Church reported, he was a first responder on two different radio shows when I interviewed him. Then at 5:20 in the afternoon, we had a classic controlled demolition of Building 7. Just fascinating. This may have been the most robust building ever designed by the hand of man. It was erected over two enormous electrical generators providing backup electricity for Manhattan. It went down in a classic controlled demolition. We even had Damned Rather comparing it to the demolition of resorts and casinos in Las Vegas live on 9/11, and he got it right. There's a pile of debris. We know from experience with controlled demolitions that the typical result is a pile of debris equal to 12% of the height of the original. Well, in the case of Building 7, that was 47 floors. So that should have been 5.5. And sure enough, we got 5.5 floors of debris from Building 7. Barry Jennings was actually in Building 7 that morning. He got out by the skin of his teeth and gave interviews there. He had gone to the command and control center, two floors that Rudy Giuliani had established, that they had their own air and water supply. And he observed, still steaming cups of coffee, have eaten sandwiches. A fireman came along and said, "We got to get you out of here." Explosions were taking place inside the building while he was still there. He felt himself stepping over dead bodies in the pitch blackness. He couldn't see them, but he felt them. There's no doubt what was going on. He got out. He was interviewed. Well, one of the glaring omissions of the 9/11 Commission report was a failure to address Building 7. They had to do a whole separate report. Well, guess what? Just days before NIST released its separate report about Building 7, Barry Jennings died. Now, he's a guy who, based on his own eyewitness testimony, would have contradicted and refuted him. In fact, we actually have Larry Silverstein giving a PBS interview where he said he was on, you know, in contact with the fire commander, though he seems to refer to him or think of him in a different way. They were discussing what to do about Building 7. And he said, well, there's been so much death and devastation, perhaps the best thing to do is just to pull it, which is a construction term for bringing by controlled demolition. Now, mind you, it takes weeks to prepare a building for a controlled demolition. You cannot just do it on the spot. Ridiculous. He said they made the decision on the scene to pull it, and we watched the building come down. A classic controlled demolition. A Danish expert in controlled demolition was shown footage of Building 7, not knowing what it was, not explaining what it was relayed to 9/11. And he said, of course, that was done by professionals. That was a classic controlled demolition. He, too, has died a mysterious death. But here's a image where you can see the debris 5.5 floors from Building 7 in the background, but in the foreground where Building 1 had stood, you can see there's nothing there. There ought to have been a pile 13.5 floors high of debris had this been any kind of a collapse. 12% of 110 floors, 13.5, but it ain't there. Meanwhile, we had Gene Stanley on the BBS declaring prematurely that the Solomon Brothers building, which was another name for Building 7, had collapsed, but in fact you could see it visible over her shoulder. This is really stunning. It happened at 4:57 when the building would not be destroyed by a classic controlled demolition until 5:20. So here she was busted on the air. This is a classic example of interaction between the intel agencies and the governments and the media, because she knew it was in the script that Building 7 was to come down. Building 7, by the way, had all kinds of evidence about investigations on Wall Street, major corporations. It had all kinds of documents and records related to Oklahoma City, too, as I understand it, and a host of other forms of malfeasance, and had to be destroyed. Meanwhile, even during the live broadcast, you already heard the report that the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine had taken responsibility, which was absurd. That was just a phone call. Anyone could make a phone call. I mean, the Palestinians were just as dumbfounded and slack-jawed at the reports of what happened as anyone else. Who could possibly have been less well-positioned to perpetrate these crimes, given what we know about how it was done, than the Palestinians? But this is classic of the Israelis. They go a bridge too far in blaming their enemies for their own acts of malfeasance. Here you had now being broadcast live after that report came out. They just happened to have at hand footage they played suggesting it was live footage of Palestinians rejoicing over what took place on 9/11. Now, this is a classic propaganda technique. I was certain at the time that was archival footage, and indeed it was, from a previous event where the Palestinians were rejoicing over some religious or political event that had led them to be so happy. Not 9/11. That was absurd. And I'm sorry to say Rudy Giuliani had a stake in all of this. This was the same day as the elections in New York City, which of course had to be postponed. I think Rudy thought he was going to be elected mayor again. I mentioned a Bureau of Transportation statistic how Ed Henry had captured. Well, here's a chart showing no American airline Flight 11 scheduled to depart Logan Airport on 9/11. It isn't there. Here's another. Original Bureau of Transportation statistic chart showing no American Airline Flight 77 scheduled to depart Washington Dulles on 9/11. It wasn't even in the air. And here's an actual copy of what I obtained from the FAA about how the two aircraft that were used for Flight 93 in Pennsylvania and Flight 175, the South Tower, were not formally deregistered until 28 September 2005, leading, I reiterate, to the problem of how can planes that weren't even in the air have crashed on 9/11, and how can planes that crashed on 9/11 have still been in the air 4 years later? And, of course, the answer is a bit obvious. The whole thing was staged, phony, fake, manufactured, another classic example of a big lie from the American government. Now, here are photographs of the 19 purported Islamic hijackers. But a half a dozen or more made contact with the British media the following day. According to the FBI, they were identified, all 19, because Mohammed Atta had made a trip, presumably from Portland, Oregon, down to Logan, but he forgot and left his luggage behind, and in the luggage, there just happened to be a convenient list of the 19 hijackers. Now ask yourself, does that make any sense whatsoever? Does that make any sense whatsoever? That you'd have a list of your 19 colleagues in a perfidious act? And why would he even be bothering with luggage? If he's going to be on a plane for a suicide, why would you bother with any luggage? Now, during a very interesting conversation I had with James Files, who's out of prison now, but who claims to have shot JFK, to have been behind the grassy knoll, and to have fired the shot that blew Jack's brains out in Dealey Plaza. We had dinner together here in Madison. I liked the guy tremendously, though I concluded that he was not, in fact, actually a second gunman on the grassy knoll, but rather was playing that designated role. He said to me that once the government takes a stand, it's locked in. It can never change. This is like the moon landing. We know we didn't have the propulsion power. We didn't have the computing power. We couldn't transit the Van Allen radiation belt. We didn't have the capacity to communicate back and forth over 250,000 miles. But the government's not going to change. It's not going to change about JFK. Even when we have proof, cast iron proof, that Lee Oswald was standing in the doorway of the Texas School Book Depository when the JFK motorcade passed by, and therefore not only cannot have been the lone gunman, but not cannot have been one of the multiple shooters, where we've identified eight shooters. Drive ID, name, rank, and serial number 6, the location, the shots they took, and the effects they had. Only Domagar, the 7th, with which I agree, leaving only the 8th, was on the south knoll by that single tree opposite the grassy knoll. You wouldn't even think there was a position for a shooter there. But I've seen two different photographs in the hands of two different experts on JFK showing the shooter standing holding his rifle, two different photographs. He was there. Since the different sponsors seek to put up their groups, I'm suspecting this may have been a shooter representing the Eastern Establishment and the Fed, because we got a Dallas deputy sheriff, a Dallas cop with ties to the CIA, we got a CIA shooter, we got an Air Force expert tying into the military, we got Lyndon Johnson personal hitman, we got an anti-Castro Cuban, we got an Israeli shooter. I mean, I'm telling you, each of the groups who were sponsoring the assassination put up their own gunmen, so they were tied together in a blood oath. Well, If a half a dozen or more of these guys turn up alive and well the following day, then obviously they didn't die in suicide crashes. And indeed, since we know Flight 11 and 77 weren't even in the air, they obviously did not crash. And since we know from pilots that Flight 93 was over Champaign-Urbana after it had allegedly crashed in Shanksville, and Flight 175 was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, after it had purportedly crashed, we know none of them died. Indeed, here is the bottom line. If no planes crashed, then no passengers died, and those Islamic hijackers caused them to crash. And if no Islamic hijackers caused them to crash, then there was no warrant or any justification for the war on terror and the invasion of all of those nations. So where did this masterful plot originate? It turns out in the late 1980s, Bibi Netanyahu and Ehud Olmert, both of whom would serve as prime ministers of Israel, devised the plan to use the destruction of the Twin Towers as a motivation for drawing American forces into the Middle East to take out the modern Arab states that served as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the entire region. Bibi even organized a conference on terrorism before the concept was even being used or aware of in the West. Terrorism, How the West Can Win, published in 1987. With the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991, there came into existence a project for a new American century that was staffed with neocons, the overwhelming majority of whom were dual U.S.-Israeli citizens, promoting the idea that the United States could establish a new American empire that would endure for the next 100 years, hence Project for the New American Empire, if only they would enter the Middle East and exert military and diplomatic pressure outward from that geopolitically sensitive area. It was a fig leaf. It was a fraud. Israel had no interest in an American empire. Israel wanted to use the United States to destroy the modern Arab governments that served as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the entire region, and then attack the Persian nation of Iran. It went very much according to plan until Russian and Iranian forces intervened in Syria at the request of Bashar al-Assad, who, unknown to most Americans, is a democratically elected president of Syria. Yes, America can't bring democracy to Syria because Syria is already a democracy. Again, how often we are lied to, how the mainstream deceives and cheats us of knowing the truth. Meanwhile, the Project for a New Century published a number of documents, including Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for a New Century, including the following crucial paragraph, because they were lamenting that with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, now that the United States was the sole remaining superpower, that the American people would be slow to appreciate the unique opportunity they confronted historically. Here's what they wrote. Further, the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor. Domestic politics and industrial policy will shape the base and content of transformation as much as the requirements of current missions. And that's why you heard immediately during 9/11 all this talk about a new Pearl Harbor. And, of course, immediately blaming the Palestinians. Do you think the Palestinians had access to mini nukes they could use to destroy the Twin Towers? Of course, we didn't know that at the time. But think about it. Do you think the Palestinians actually had the opportunity to hijack aircraft that weren't even in the air that day, or to commandeer others that were still flying 4 years later? I mean, the poppycock, the bullshit we've been fed over 9/11 is simply mind-boggling. Meanwhile, Wesley Clark at the Commonwealth Club on October 3rd, 2007, explained what he'd learned. When Clark, after 9/11, had returned from serving as Supreme Commander Allied Forces Europe, meaning he was a commanding general of NATO, he returned to the Pentagon and encountered a general of his acquaintance who explained to him that we were planning to invade Iraq. And they both thought that was very odd because Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. So he just asked the general to keep him posted. He returned months later and ran into the same general. And he asked, are we still planning to invade Iraq? And the general said, oh, no, sir, it's much worse now. We're planning to attack 7 countries in the next 5 years. Step into my office. And Wesley Clark was dumbfounded. He said, why are we going to do this? And the general said, I don't know. I guess we're just good at it. And he said, well, is this memorandum classified? And he said, oh, yes, sir. Well, then don't share it with me, said Wesley Clark, because I may want to discuss it. Well, not until October 3rd, 2007, at the Commonwealth Club of California in San Francisco, did Wesley Clark reveal the true agenda. It was to follow through to promote the Israeli plan to expand to a greater Israel by taking out the modern Arab states that served as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the entire region. Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle were among the foremost proponents of these attacks. They were in the brain trust that brought us 9/11. There are traitors to the United States. At the New York Port Authority, we had Frank Lowry, Ronald Outer, and Paul Eisenberg, who were prominent Zionists involved in a transfer of the property to Silverstein Properties. Larry Silverstein, personal friend of Bibi Netanyahu. They would have conversations, phone conversations, every Sunday. It was his practice, since taking possession of the World Trade Center just 6 weeks before the event, at which time he fired the security firm that had been looking after the World Trade Center since it first opened in 1970 and replaced it with an Israeli firm. He renegotiated the insurance contract to have an anti-terrorism clause, whereby claiming there had been 2 planes and therefore 2 attacks, he claimed double indemnity and was awarded $4.5 billion on a $114 million investment. The day of 9/11, even though he and his daughter, who also worked at the World Trade Center, were accustomed to having breakfast every morning at Windows of the World, a restaurant atop the North Tower, that day he didn't come. She didn't come either. I had a little old lady from Brooklyn call me and tell me how their rabbi had warned the synagogue not to go into Lower Manhattan that day. We know the Odago messaging system, also an Israeli op, was warning any who worked, Jewish employees of the World Trade Center were warned not to go in. So that the max number, so far as I can discern, of those who are Jewish who died on 9/11 was countable on one finger of one hand. Meanwhile, the replacement was with Kroll to have this new security service. Odago, even Willie Brown, claimed that he'd been warned, and it appears he was warned by Condoleezza Rice not to fly on 9/11. Of course, he wants to take it back. We have all this evidence of the complicity of the Bush-Cheney administration, including Condoleezza Rice. There's not a shred of evidence any of the 9/11 hijackers actually boarded any of the planes, as Craig McKee has published long since. To believe the official story of 9/11, you have to swallow an awful lot. You have to believe the laws of physics can be suspended for a day, that planes can disappear after crashing, and that Muslims accused of being suicide hijackers can still be alive after the deed is done. Well said. Meanwhile, guess what? It turns out the 9/11 hijacker passports were issued by the CIA. How about that? Whistleblower Michael Springman ordered to give visas to the eventual terrorist. Whistleblower Indira Singh claiming the company PTAC had access to all FAA databases for 2 hours on the morning of 9/11 to keep track. All these Israeli operations. And of course, I don't need to remind you about the $2.3 trillion missing from the Pentagon. Rumsfeld, as a sophisticated politician, would normally never make such an announcement early in the week because the story would develop and grow legs. Instead, he announced it as though he were aware that something would intervene in the meanwhile and he'd be able to walk back into the halls of Congress and ask for hundreds of billions more in defense spending, which is exactly what transpired. Dov Zakheim, as I observed, was a controller of the Pentagon, not only a rabbi. He had a company that manufactured aircraft control systems that can take over and remotely control an aircraft should it be subjected to a hijacking. I am convinced that the original plan was to use remotely controlled planes to hit the North and the South Tower. It was only after they discovered that it was physically impossible for real planes to penetrate the steel facade, that they would have crumbled external to the building, that they realized they had to devise an alternative plan because they had to get the planes into the buildings before they exploded, to have the pseudo justification for claiming it was the intense fires that caused the steel to melt and for the buildings to collapse, where we had the Harley guy rush right up. I mean, this was on television, a guy obviously a plant. Everyone is scratching their heads as to why the South Tower should have collapsed. And there was that oddity that the top section of the South Tower tilted to the side before it was blown apart. And he said, well, wearing a Harley Davidson shirt, the intense fire from the jet fuel must have caused the steel beams to weaken and even melt and cause the top floors to collapse on the lower floors and bring about the destruction of the buildings. It was all poppycock. It was all nonsense, but it went out as a first impression and initial explanation, and psychologists will tell you how important those are. So you see how getting that initial phone call from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, showing that classic footage of Palestinians rejoice and having the Harley guy rush up and say, well, it must have been the intense heat from the jet fuel, which under optimal condition would still burn 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit too low to cause the steel to weaken or even melt. Just to give you an illustration, in fact, back in 1975, there actually was an enormous fire on the 13th floor of the North Tower. It burned at an estimated 4,000 degrees. And the fire chief explained how, even though there was this intense fire, they didn't have to replace any of the steel. They didn't have to replace any of the steel. And in fact, they did replace part of the steel, but that was only for psychological reasons. It was at this point they installed the sprinkler system. Let me add, so that sprinkler system would have extinguished the very modest fires that resulted from the planes having crashed. In fact, in the South Tower, there was a fire captain up there saying, we only need two lines. There are pretty modest fires here we can extinguish, which appears to have been the signal for them destroying the South Tower, because once you put out the fire, there's no explanation or excuse. And it was Willie Rodriguez who observed that the sub-basements were filling with water, which I learned from him after he came here to Madison and gave a talk about 9/11, and Kevin Barrett and I were having dinner with him in the aftermath, and I realized those earlier explosions had to be to take out the sprinkler systems, which otherwise would have extinguished the very modest fires. And, of course, we had that hand-eye coordination problem, so they actually hit. The explosions occurred 14 and 17 seconds before the planes actually made contact with the building, hence seismic proof. 9/11 was an inside job. Just brilliant research that's been done. Now, when they organized the 9/11 commission, it was a result of political pressure generated by four widows who came to be known as the Jersey Girls, whose husbands had been killed in 9/11. They were employees at the World Trade Center. Dick Cheney and W put off as long as they could even appointing a 9/11 commission. for 441 days. I mean, think how absurd that is. After Pearl Harbor, FDR, after JFK, LBJ, appointed commissions right off the bat. I mean, no time delay to speak of whatsoever. And while they, especially in the case of LBJ, may have had their own impure motives for doing so, nevertheless, that ought to have been expected for 9/11. They originally sought to appoint Henry Kissinger to head the 9/11 commission. Well, Henry's a great choice if you want to cover things up, but he would have had to reveal his financial entanglements, so he declined the honor. Instead, they turned to an obscure academician by the name of Philip Zelikow, who's now a member of the Department of History at the University of Virginia, where I taught twice, as a visiting associate professor in 1977-78, and then back in the spring of 81 as a visiting full professor, Mr. Jefferson University, to be the executive director. Now get this. Philip Zelikow had as his area of academic specialization before entering government service the creation and the maintenance of public myths, M-Y-T-H-S. Philip Zelikow completed a draft of the 9/11 Commission report a year before he shared it with many members of the staff and before they'd conducted their hearings or their hearings had been complete. I believe that Philip Zelikow authored the script for 9/11. Who better to put in charge of the 9/11 Commission than the very guy who authored the script? If you think of a theory about 9/11 as suspended in space and then connected to evidence by links of evidence to the 9/11 calls, it turns out they weren't even physically possible at the speeds of the aircraft at the time. The passenger list report, all fabricated. The destruction of the Twin Towers, completely different than we're told. The crash sites, all four fabricated or fake. Every element that's supposed to connect this theory suspended in space to reality have proven to be false and fabricated. And I believe it was just a brilliant stroke. Let me tell you how far it went. It turns out that shorts had been placed on American and United Airlines, which means a prediction that their stock is going to fall before 9/11, which were traced back to, guess what, the CIA. And the co-directors of the 9/11 Commission said, well, you know, there was some thought there was suspicion there, but it turned out to have no basis because the party who put the shorts could not have been responsible. I mean, how stupid and naive is that? Here we have Bibi Netanyahu and Ehud Olmert consulting among themselves as a brain trust who brought us 9/11. And here's Dick Cheney and George W. Bush. There's a fascinating story about Bush, by the way, when he came to Booker Elementary in Sarasota, Bradenton. I was actually living in Bradenton, Florida at the time, and Booker Elementary wasn't that far away. And, it was later that I would be living in Bradenton, Florida. It would be 80. But the point is that at Booker's school, Bush would sit in a classroom and talking with students about a story about my pet goat that he was holding upside down. When Andy Kurd, his press secretary, came in and told him America was under attack. Very bizarre. Bush would several times report in public that he had seen the first plane hit the North Tower. Now, that was not broadcast on television. That was not even known to have occurred, that there was any video footage until the following day when the Nade brothers, and as I mentioned, Nade is an anagram for Dwayne Street, where it was filmed, the Nade brothers' footage would be released. He said he thought to himself, man, what a terrible pilot. Well, that occurred when he was in the presidential limousine approaching Booker Elementary. He had to have seen it on Secret Service closed television. That means the Secret Service had a television camera pointed at that facade of the North Tower. Normally, an object of boredom. What possible interest could there be in having a camera pointed at that facade of the North Tower? Well, Bush repeatedly said he thought what a terrible pilot. It was only after he heard from Andy Card that there had been a second attack that he realized what had happened. Bush was going to say it a third time, so they edited it out, wouldn't let him do it. Thierry Meyssan, let me say, got it right. He published early on about the Pentagon saying, hunt the Boeing. Look as hard as you can. You won't find any evidence of a Boeing aircraft. He was among the very first whistleblowers, and I salute him on this occasion. Thierry Meyssan, completely brilliant. Meanwhile, among the few of my books, Amazon, well, of my books with Moonrock Books that Amazon has not banned, where I have 8 or 9 and Amazon had banned 6, they have not banned America Nuked on 9/11, compliments of the CIA, the neocons, and the DOD, and the Mossad. On the back cover, I have that bubbler photograph. Does this look like any kind of collapse? The Twin Towers were masterpieces of design and engineering. They were virtually incapable of collapse, but blown apart in every direction from the top down in only 9 seconds for the South Tower and 11 for the North. Did you know that a third building, WTC-7, actually did collapse at 5:20 p.m. ET, which was about 7 hours after the North Tower was destroyed? Did you know it was not hit by any plane and had no jet fuel-based fires? Did you know the most striking piece of aircraft debris on the Pentagon lawn came from a crash of a Boeing 757 near Cali, Colombia in 1995? It follows that 9/11 was not done by 19 Islamic terrorists. If you want to know the who, the why, and the how, and the why, the answers are found here, including contribution by Ed Ward, M.D., Jeff Prager, Susan Lindauer, Preston James, Ph.D., Dennis Camino, Jack White, Nicholas Kullerstrom, Ph.D., Mike Palachek, Mark Hightower, Jim Fetzer, Ph.D., Steve Fahaney, an aeronautical engineer, Joshua Blakely, and Don Fox. You can get that at Moonrock Books. Meanwhile, if you want another video that closely corresponds to what you've had here, then go to 911scholars.org, because they've taken my blog, my jamesfetzer.org, in order to deprive the public of access to the vast repository I had there of information about Sandy Hook. They've also taken down many of the other links I had there, but remaining is my 9/11 special dedicated to Robert David Steele. So I encourage you, for more on 9/11, check it out, 911scholars.org. Don't let yourself be played. Have a great weekend and think about what we've been living through.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and